This BizNews briefing is brought to you by Investec Business Banking. Make the move to transactional banking with simple, transparent fees. Well, if you haven't been following the Donald Trump versus ANC fracas over the past week, I don't know what cave you've been in. But France Cronier has got some sobering advice for those who are cheering on the ANC's belligerence towards US President Donald Trump. He says the risk of 1985-style sanctions is growing. I spoke with him earlier today. The full interview is on BizNews TV. Here's part of the highlights.
If South Africa wishes to survive as a unitary state, not to fragment and break up into enclaves, a kind of balkanization. Remember, it's a very young country. Only really come together 110 years ago or so. If it wishes to do that, and if it wishes to remain a member of the liberal democratic order, then it needs to vastly improve its economic performance to create the kind of society in which any child born into it can rightly aspire to a middle-class standard of living. And if it fails at that and continues to exclude vast numbers, particularly young people, from full participation in the economy, the opinion in South Africa will later radicalize and the country will fragment and it will fall out of the league of the liberal democratic order. And the United States is important to South Africa in the sense that the economic and diplomatic and cultural relationships across the Atlantic are essential to determining which direction Africa goes. If the tie with the U.S. is fundamentally broken, it will later also be broken with the rest of the Western liberal order, and South Africa will ultimately fail in key respects. If the tie is well established and excellent relations on all those three levels occur, then South Africa should ultimately succeed.
Why is this latest, what is being perceived by the ANC, assault on South Africa's sovereignty, relevant in that context?
Well, it's relevant because if the relationship continues along the trajectory that it's now moving, what's going to happen is that the developmental relationship that USAID will be gone, AGOA will be cancelled, and there will be sanctions brought against South Africa. So that's why it's important now. We're not far from that point.
But sanctions? Would they really go that far? And does that mean Kentucky Fried Chicken, McDonald's, Ford, IBM, Microsoft, Amazon would have to pull out?
I'm not sure what form it would take, but thinking in that direction would not be an exaggeration of what is now possible.
France, is what you're telling us potentially then a repeat of what we saw in 1985 when B.W. Botha stood up and wagged his finger at the Rubicon speech, and thereafter Willard C. Butcher of Chase Manhattan Bank stopped all loans to South Africa. We became a capital exporter. There was massive divestment from this company, this country. Interest rates went to 25%, etc. Are we at one of those moments?
We're at a similar moment. That's exactly the thing to remind people of. That he wagged the finger. Chase Manhattan said we won't roll over the loans. And South Africa is essentially bankrupt. What's very different is at that moment there was a second parallel process in place in order to help maintain the relationship. much of that was the Sullivan principles era. And what had happened in the background is Americans with foresight, drawing heavily on Chester Crocker, who was then the Assistant Secretary of State's constructive engagement policy, had been to see key South African leaders and had said to them, look, the American business community is going to break from many of the, certainly the petty apartheid prescriptions and regulations, and are going to begin treating South Africa as if it is already a reformed kind of a state. And in one of those engagements, the relevant minister also wagged his finger at the chap who'd gone to see him and said, you do not think that you can push this country around. We won't tolerate this, similar to the contemporary response to the U.S. And in that meeting, the minister then asked his aide to leave the room and fetch the tea or something. And when the young aide had left, who was obviously there to supervise the minister, because you can never trust the minister, the minister said to the chap who can't see him on behalf of the Americans, listen, he said, what you guys are doing is the most important thing that happened in this country, and we support you. We need to change. My government will have to attend. You know, we've got to keep our end up. You know, all that. It's still pretty early in the process. So there was a very important parallel process underway that sought to salvage the relationship and use American investment as a constructive input to help South Africa reform to a point where it would, after the moment of reform, ultimately wanting for remain a, or be become a evolved to be a liberal democratic state. One of the dangers in this moment is that those same parallel structures of the same foresight, ability, and sophistication are not in place, and therefore the relationship here can fracture.
Yeah, there's a lot more to that interview as well, where he explains the DA is burying itself by being part of the government of national unity. Certainly the people who put the DA into that powerful position are very disillusioned, according to Dr. Krunya, who's one of our eminent political scientists. And he also says that you've got to look behind the rhetoric to see exactly why the United States and President Trump are so angry with South Africa. And one of the lines that he highlights is the concern that South Africa is enabling Iran and its nuclear weapons program. Remember, South Africa was a nuclear power until 1994 when it gave up its nuclear weapons. Neil De Beer and his Sunday show with Chris Stain is one of the highlights for the BizNews tribe. Well, this clip that we're going to play now, which came out of yesterday's show, is going to be something that they're going to be returning to, as will I, for some time into the future. It's the leader of the UIM's view on where we are right now and what needs to be done.
The fact of the matter is that this country is at a crossing line. We might not think it, but we are. We have a multitude of racial explosions, of matters to be tested, of, for the first time again since 93, 94, having to sit down and say that all the people of this country, the Constitution, the dream of a rainbow nation, the walks of Madiba's reconciliation, the TRC, the getting on with it, the great games that we have won on the field and off the field, the inspiration of a beautiful country, a country where people were willing to die, black and white, a country where we stood on principles, a country where no matter how ill you are, how dark it gets, how black and white destroy each other, how people can stand on a podium and say, kill the white. And yesterday, where a parliamentarian can sit on Twitter, a parliamentarian of this country, a person that took an oath, an allegiance to defend the democracy and constitution, that a parliamentarian in this country, when said by another parliamentarian, what is the solution about the Afrikaners and the whites in this country? Can we not get Cyril to give them aeroplanes to leave for free? And the answer on a public social media platform from this parliamentarian is two words. Plaasmoord. This is a person that is a parliamentarian who says that the solution now is not to get Afrikaner white people to leave this country in aeroplanes, but he shockingly says the solution is farm murders. I don't care, Chris, on what side of the divide you are. I don't care what is your politics. But when we have come to a point in this country where elected governmental officials have the same right to sit on a public platform and use the same kind of words they used in Rwanda to say, kill the cockroaches. And what happened there? We have really this week, in my opinion, hit the lowest of the low in 30 years when this is allowed and when this kind of hate speech is now being projected. So, Chris, in conclusion, yes, South Africa has come to many crossroads now. But I will say, Chris, I am a patriot of this country. I was born here, and I am willing to put the lights off if necessary. We will have to really dig deep this week. We will really have to have introspection, no matter whom you are and what you are. Because, Chris, if we love our country so dearly, if we love this land that we are born, no matter where we are, if you are sitting in the Karoo, the Veldbos van die Langeveld, the thundering waves of Umhlanga, the Dragonian mountains of the Drakensberg or the flat roads of the Free State, the beautiful flowers on the west coast, the Bokoms van Saldanha of the Kaapse Klopse, on the Table Mountain, I beg the leaders of this country to stop your absolute hogwash, to remember why you are there, and to do anything, Chris, necessary, even if it means that you've got to take the knee, go back to your foundation, but save this country and its beautiful people. That's my message today on BizNews. A bit emotional, but clear. I am a grandfather, and my little boy, Aiden, must know what a beautiful country he was born in. The end.
In the world of business banking, the bottom line can often triumph over relationships. At Investec, we value both. Make the move from business as usual to Investec Business Banking. Out of the ordinary.
At SunExchange, we make going solar simple, profitable, and completely risk-free. Join over 100 satisfied South African customers already enjoying the benefits of risk-free solar. Start saving today. Visit sunexchange.com and join the solar revolution.
Hey, we've got a powerful program for you tonight. Well, on social media, there's been a lot of discussion about the offer by President Trump to Afrikaners to be given refugee status in the United States. Much of the discourse on social media was, well, the Afrikaners really couldn't care. None of them would be interested in going anyway. They've got it so good here, blah, blah, blah. That's not the truth, as we find out now from Neil Diamond, who is the chief executive of the SA Chamber of Commerce in the United States. He spoke last night with my colleague, Linda van Tilburg.
In the first few hours after the news broke and it went live, we received thousands of emails, text messages, WhatsApps, Facebook Messenger messages, and to an extent that our system actually crashed. We couldn't deal with just the sheer volume that was coming through. What we have done is we've subsequently put a link on our website where people can register for information only. It's not a register for benefits or anything to become a refugee. It's just so that we can share information. At this stage, we've had outreaches of over 17,000 South Africans expressing interest in becoming refugees in the United States of America.
And now, are they all Afrikaans?
Well, to be honest with you, how do you test an Afrikaner? I've got an English name and an English surname, but I know if we start conversing in Afrikaans, you will hear that I'm a native speaker. I grew up Afrikaans, went to an Afrikaans primary school, high school. I'm a product of the Rand Afrikaans University. So, you know, how are we fully going to define that? I don't know if they're all Afrikaans. Most of the emails I received were in English, most of them were on behalf of their families. So up and above the number that I have mentioned, which is well over 17,500, we can time that by about four if we look at families and added family members. At this stage, we're estimating about 50,000 people reached out to us in the last 2 days, warm bodies that would like to move to the United States from South Africa. And that's shocking. But there's no way of quantifying this. Further to that, this is honestly hot off the press. This happened at 5 p.m. U.S. time on the East Coast that we got this news, or that this news broke. This news broke in South Africa during the nighttime of Saturday morning. So we've got no further information other than the executive order. We don't know how it's going to be implemented. What are the scale and scope of that? How are we going to define Afrikaners? That is all information that we are still waiting for. As the South African Chamber of Commerce in the U.S., we have reached out to the U.S. mission in South Africa. We wrote a letter to the Charles de Affairs. As you know, the U.S. ambassador to South Africa returned early January to inquire as to the process that would be followed to firstly get South Africans onto a list somewhere, and then secondly, what would be the criteria? How would they adjudicate that? What's the process that will be followed to resettle South Africans to the United States? So at this stage, there's not much that we can share. We know that the impact's going to be severe, and we know that the overwhelming number that have expressed interest will only grow in the coming weeks and days.
Well, the problem, I guess, that many people have with all of this is that there is a huge demand of people to get into the United States. We just have a look at the millions of illegal immigrants that Trump is now trying to eject. And that's because they got a good system. They got an economy that grows. They've got freedom. And South Africans, well, many South Africans, as you heard from Neil Diamond there, are also wanting to get a fast track into the U.S. Well, on a broader basis now, closer to home, the concerns that exist in the DRC continue. The Economist, our partners in London, interviewed the leader of the DRC's rebel group, M23. That's the organization that bested the South African National Defense Force and others. Here's some insights into what they found.
Corné Nanga sits in an armchair in a five-star hotel in Goma, the largest city in Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo, and stretches out his hand. "Thank you for embracing the terrorists," he jokes, to laughter from his entourage. Mr. Nanga claims that M23's fight is a local one. "Our vocation is the absence of the state," he explains. "We are Congolese, and we have problems and demands that are Congolese. These include," he says, "ending the corrupt role of Congo's president, Felix Tshisekedi, in his repression of the political opposition, and above all, the exclusion of some ethnic communities, especially the Tutsis." Mr. Nonga, who is not Tutsi, has vowed to go as far as Congo's capital, Kinshasa, in support of these aims. The cause is such that our young people may advance until the last drop of blood. On the ground in eastern Congo, the conflict might yet expand. There are fears the rebels will march further into neighbouring South Kivu province and capture or besiege the city of Bukavu. Mr. Nonga would not comment, but said that if military attacks keep originating from Bukavu's airport, M23 would silence the guns there. Burundian forces in the province also pose a threat, he said. On February 3rd, the rebels declared a unilateral ceasefire, but it seems to have rapidly broken down. M23 has long pushed for direct talks with the Congolese government, but the government in Kinshasa has always rejected the prospect. Now, in an ominous sign, Mr. Nonga cast doubt on the very possibility of negotiations. There are lots of preconditions, he said, without naming any. How can you place your trust in a crook like Tshisekedi? Sharp and surprisingly jolly for an internationally sanctioned rebel threatening regional chaos, Mr. Nonga offers to exchange phone numbers. Everyone's afraid to call me, he says, to more laughter.
Fascinating story, which is on biznews.com. Well, peace seems to be breaking out between the golfing world's controlling bodies. Scott O'Neill, who is Live Golf's new CEO, spoke to our partners at Bloomberg.
You know, we have been for, of, and about growing the game of golf. And there are so many new and exciting leaders. If you look at Derek Sprague at PGA of America and Mark Darbin at the RNA, and I'm new at LIV, and I know the PGA is looking for a new executive as well to work alongside Jay. And I think that provides an opportunity for us all to take a step back, appreciate where we are in this moment of time, and move forward. The fact that the leader of the free world, the President of the United States, thinks that golf is this important that he can engage, makes us really happy and validates how important this game is. And I still believe it's one of life's great teachers and just as important as we could possibly find today in bringing this game together. So any news that brings us closer to that, I think is really welcome news for all the golf fans around the world.
Have you spoken to the president directly yourself?
I have not, no. In a few weeks, we'll be in Miami playing at Doral, which is a Trump course. And I imagine he'll make an appearance there. But, you know, in these first 30 days, I've had the time of my life, getting to know these incredible stars like Brooks Koepka and Dustin Johnson and Bryson DeChambeau. We have the best players from around the world. That's been an experience. Getting ready for this incredible event season, kicking off in Riyadh, and getting our feet under us and planning for the future.
Now, I know you're not in position to give us the contours of the deal, but is it your expectation that if a deal does come to fruition, that it would allow for more coexistence between LIV players and the PGA Tour? Is it your expectation that ultimately LIV players could participate in the PGA Tour without being penalized?
You know, our focus right now is on making sure we take the best players in the world to the best locations in the world. It's a deal and a construct that we've all been working on for some time, and we're all focused on the same goals and objectives, and that is to grow this game, put as many of the greatest players on the biggest stages of the world. And while I'd love to walk chapter and verse into the deal, I will tell you that anything that's good for this game is good for LIV, and we're thrilled that there's progress being made.
Yeah. One recent development earlier this week, the U.S. Open became the first major to actually create an exemption for LIV golf players. Do you expect other majors to follow suit as well?
You know, very appreciative of Mike Wan and his leadership at the USGA. We heard today from Mark Darbin, who runs the RNA and the Open Championship, and they will be following suit. And at least the early conversations with Derek Sprague at the PGA of America are very positive as well.
So lots of positive news on the golf front, and the intervention there of Donald Trump again is interesting to note. Well, those who have followed the Biz News portfolio over the last 10 years have done very well out of it. And our best performer in recent times was a company called MicroStrategy. We invested there because it was a proxy for Bitcoin. And also, it leveraged to Bitcoin. At the time, you could not invest in Bitcoin on any of the international exchanges. It's been a phenomenal performer. We put 2% of the portfolio into MicroStrategy. It has now turned into 10% of the portfolio. It has subsequently been sold, and the proceeds have been put into a Bitcoin exchange traded fund. Sitting at 10%, thank you very much, coming from 2. But MicroStrategy itself has now spawned a whole host of copycats. Our partners at the Financial Times of London explain why.
The software service provider, Strategy, formerly known as MicroStrategy, is inspiring a lot of copycats these days for what it's doing with Bitcoin, specifically hoarding it. The company started an aggressive crypto buying spree back in 2020 to increase its share price, and the bet seems to have paid off. Now, Strategy is inspiring a number of other companies to do the same. Nicu Asghari is here to tell me whether there might be a catch. Hey, Nicu.
Hi.
So what's the backstory to Strategy and its interest in Bitcoin? I mean, why did the company start gobbling up all this cryptocurrency?
So Michael Saylor, the co-founder of the company, started this because he really believes in Bitcoin as an asset, as the future of money. And he started buying Bitcoin slowly and now much, much more aggressively in a mixture of ways. So they raise equity from the stock market, from shareholders, and then use that money to buy Bitcoin. And they've also started raising debt and various different types of debt, and then also use that money to buy Bitcoin. They hold now just over 2% of all the Bitcoin in the world, and they're the biggest corporate holder of Bitcoin. And as the value of the Bitcoin goes up, so does the value of Strategy's shares.
All right, so what's the verdict? How has Strategy made out under this approach?
It's worked out incredibly well for them. I mean, Strategy as a business, they reported their full year 2024 earnings last week, and they made about $464 million in revenue from the core of the business, the software stuff. But if you look at the share price, the valuation of the company is $84 billion, which is crazy. That's such a huge disparity. And that is really all down to the fact that investors are so happy and investing because of the Bitcoin that it holds, not because of the software stuff.
And I mentioned that, you know, other companies are starting to copy Strategy's approach here. What kind of companies are looking into this and why?
Yeah, there's a whole handful. So on one side, you've got Bitcoin miners, crypto-specific companies that, you know, obviously believe in Bitcoin. And as part of their balance sheet, they are adding and holding Bitcoin. That's one thing. But then on the other side, and what I think is more interesting, is a bunch of companies that have nothing to do with Bitcoin. For example, one that I spoke to is KULR Technology. It's a small cap US company, and they help people like NASA and the US Navy manage their thermal energy equipment. They've started also doing this. I mean, there's a bunch of pharmaceutical companies, again, completely unrelated to crypto, their fundamental businesses. But in order to help scare off short sellers, maybe, who are in the stock, they've also started buying this because they see that holding Bitcoin has so far helped boost the share prices.
But I have to imagine that this being Bitcoin, there have to be some concerns here. So what's the risk to this strategy?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the huge overarching risk is if or when, depending on who you speak to, the price of Bitcoin collapses, then the value of the company also collapses, because really the value of the company is just tied to how much Bitcoin they hold. So think about Strategy. I mean, no one really thinks about it as a software business anymore or cares about that side of the business. It's completely evolved into becoming just a huge pile of Bitcoin. And that is where shareholders think that the value is.
Well, what kind of precedent does crypto hoarding set for companies? I mean, do you think we're going to see more of it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I spoke to a investor who is specifically looking to invest in companies doing this. And he said he was knocking on doors of companies that he thought were suitable and, you know, small enough, and their share price was the right sort of target to encourage them to do this. And I think, obviously, we've got the overarching, very crypto-friendly US under President Donald Trump at the moment, which just sort of boosts demand for crypto and boosts demand for Bitcoin. So I think don't be surprised if you see more and more companies getting into this.
Fascinating story in a world that is transforming so rapidly. As Neil Dibia said earlier in the program, this is a heck of a week, especially for South Africa. Well, Bronwyn, we'll be back with you tomorrow evening. Until then, from the BizNews team, cheerio. This BizNews briefing is brought to you by Investec Business Banking. Make the move to finance solutions that enable real growth.